Thanks for downloading the talk show from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. A decade ago, if you told a friend you were planning to build a greenhouse, they would likely have envisioned a little glass building designed to keep your fragile plants thriving throughout the winter. Today, many more Americans are familiar with the concept of green construction, which can encompass everything from energy-efficient windows and low-flow showerheads to solar-generated electricity and rain-barrel irrigation. But how often are builders and the homebuyers they serve actually using the new technologies that make a house environmentally friendly? And what should consumers know about their options for building a greenhouse from the ground up or converting an existing one? Joining us to provide some of the answers are Jim Motovalli, editor of E, the environmental magazine, and Ann Fetti, who is chairman of the Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas's Green Building Initiative. Welcome both of you to the program.
Great to be on.
Dan, we'll start with you. What are the sort of requirements of your organization to certify a house as green construction?
We have 38 base elements that comprise the sort of the bottom of the tier for measuring up to in order for a house to be called green built according to our certification method. Our program, as a matter of fact, it just got its new name. It is Green Built North Texas. The categories include site management and waste recycling, water efficiency, energy efficiency, indoor air quality, resource efficiency. That would be like efficient use of the building materials that are comprising the house, and then finally homeowner education.
And how many of those adjustments to what would be standard make a difference in the way people live in the house? How many of them do people notice? In other words, is it a different experience to live in a greenhouse?
I would say probably so, but in a very encouraging way. Picture yourself, for example, living in a home that has a big rain barrel in the backyard. A house's project that I'm working on now in Denton has just that. We have 1,500 gallon cisterns in the backyard that are holding rainwater that we've caught from runoff from the roof, and we're using that rainwater on all the 14 houses in that subdivision to provide for all of the landscape irrigation needs. All right, if you're living in a house that's got a 1,500-gallon tank in your backyard, it kind of, you know, it occupies your consciousness. What I would expect that it does is it's sort of a constant reminder of things like resource efficiency, making the best use of the resources that we have available. I'll bet you folks that have those tanks in the backyard are going to discipline themselves differently because they can walk out in the backyard and pound on the side of the tank and know how much water's left in it, you know, how much watering they can do if they really want to limit their irrigation to, you know, just what's in the tank.
That's a great point that it sort of makes you more conscious even after you've taken that step of conserving resources. Jim, do you find that people are – that it takes sort of taking the first step for people to consider themselves really environmentally conscious?
Yeah, well, I think it can be done very simply. You don't have to immediately invest in a wholesale makeover of your home. You can start with little things like putting in compact fluorescent bulbs or a programmable thermostat, and you can gradually green your home that way. I would point out one of the problems of the green building movement is that when people build new green homes, they tend to be very large. I mean, we're talking like 4,000 or 5,000 square feet homes, and many of the gains you get from making the houses energy efficient, for example, are lost because of the sheer size of the place. And I think a really good thing to start with is looking at how much space you actually need, because smaller is also greener.
Are you starting to see, Dan, people asking for smaller homes? Or this part of Texas, it seems everybody wants a gigantic house.
Right, that's the big problem.
As a matter of fact, that project that I was referring to you is one that I'm doing in collaboration with Denton Affordable Housing Corporation. The houses, there are four basic floor plans ranging in size from 1,180 square feet to 1,600 square feet. And the project is intended for sale. Designed and built to be affordable in terms of first cost to low to moderate income families. So picture a family of five earning less than $50,000 a year, for example. That family should be able to afford the homes that we're building out there, both in terms of the initial cost and a significantly lower operating expense for electricity, natural gas, water.
That's really great on two levels, both because the house has a smaller footprint and because it's affordable, which is the other big problem with eco homes. They tend to be very high-end, very expensive.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I was involved in a very large, ambitious project a couple of years ago, and I was kind of bragging about it to my friends, and they said, well, yeah, we'll come back and brag when you can build something the rest of us can afford. So I am.
Initially, I know it was more expensive for a lot of the things that we would consider to be environmentally responsible. Is that starting to change now that more people want green construction and green elements in their homes? Are they becoming more affordable based on demand?
I think both that and I guess ingenuity. The state of the art is emerging. It has not yet achieved its end. So we're a lot smarter in terms of the green building potentials out there than we were 5, 10, 20 years ago. And as a result, we can now choose products that work really good that don't cost a whole lot.
I could add another example that things like solar panels that you may want to include as part of your eco home have come down a lot in price. Not only that, but there are federal and state subsidies for installing environmental things like solar panels. In Connecticut, you can get, for instance, more than half of the cost of installation covered by various grants, and I think that's really made it more possible for people to do.
That's really great. I know a number of states around the country do that. Texas does not have provisions like that right now for photovoltaics.
There are some federal tax breaks, though,
are there
not?
There are federal tax breaks. That's correct.
And the places, I guess, you can go online and probably find that out on...
It's not all federal. In Connecticut, we have the Clean Energy Fund that is paid for by utilities. It's taken out of consumer bills. And that provides a huge pool of money that has really jump-started the photovoltaic business in Connecticut. We had like two solar installers about 5 years ago. Now there's about 20, and they're all coming in from other states. Really jump-started it.
Is there? I would think that that photovoltaics would be less effective in a place like Connecticut, where it seems cloudier and colder and more filled with trees. I'm wondering, Jim, if there are differences regionally about according to the things that people want to do to build a green home.
Well, I think there definitely are. For instance, you're not going to be able to successfully install a wind turbine unless you have a wind resource. And I'm on my town's Energy Task Force, and we're actually looking at installing a community wind turbine as part of our work. We just happen to be located on Long Island Sound, where there just happens to be enough wind resource to make that probably the only practical place in Connecticut to have a wind turbine. Now, Texas happens to be a great wind state and probably has more wind per capita or per square mile than any other state in the country, and it's sort of a combination of you need the geographic factors, you need the physical conditions, but you also need a receptive government environment.
I agree with you. I wanted to kind of add for all the listeners that a couple of the things we're talking about, the wind turbines and the photovoltaic arrays on roofs, even though the price on those things has come down pretty dramatically in the past few years, they still are fairly expensive additions to a home. And this project up in Denton that I'm working on does not have photovoltaics, nor does it even have a solar collector on the roof. Solar collector is a device for heating water to provide domestic hot water in the house. Instead, we relied on some cutting-edge technologies, other tried-and-true methods. But as a result of all of those things, still in the affordable range, we were able to sell those houses with an energy use guarantee that relates to the amount of, or that guarantees basically that the amount of electricity and natural gas necessary to comfortably cool and heat the houses does not exceed a particular amount. And for our 1,340 square foot model home, that guarantee translates at today's utility costs to less than $50 a month for heating and cooling the house. That's about, we're figuring about $100 a month savings over a baseline house.
So, Dan, why is it that everybody isn't doing this? Why isn't every house
being
built
this way?
That
was what I was thinking exactly.
Well, because we haven't had to. Because up until the very recent past, energy has been very, very inexpensive. The building industry is a large institution with folks that, you know, in many respects learned the trade from their fathers or from, their bosses and became carpenters and electricians and various things, doing it the same way that they had been taught to do it, early on. And we are talking about different techniques. There is a little bit of a learning curve, and it's cumbersome. And because of all of that, and we haven't really had to do it because energy was cheap, people just kept on doing things the same way they always did. And now it's a different story.
Are there any older technologies that either one of you is aware of that have actually come back into vogue because they're better for energy efficiency or resource conservation than what had been used in the recent past?
Well, I would mention the wind turbine as an example of that, since that's hundreds of years old. The fuel cell is another one. While we're looking at the possibility of fuel cells in homes that would actually take you off the grid, that's still a little bit in the future. But the fuel cell was invented in the mid-19th century, so that's an old technology, too. I also want to make another point in terms of why everybody hasn't done this. I was reading an interview with Amory Lovins, and he talked about how he had proposed a retrofit to an office building in Chicago that could actually save a whole lot of money by changing the windows to more efficient windows. If you looked at it, say, over 10 years, there'd be substantial savings to the building owner. But that did not happen, even though he was able to prove how much money they'd save, simply because the building owner and the person who leases the building had different objectives and different goals, and the person leasing the building didn't want to be out 3 months while the windows were going to be replaced. They'd lose the revenue from the tenants. So that kind of thing will just get in the way of this kind of innovation, even if it saves money. Now, we've seen the same thing in my town. As I said, I'm on this task force, and despite the fact that the public works director is probably the greenest one in the entire 50 states, he still sees buildings being built under his aegis that don't include a lot of the things he wants to do, and it's what your other guest mentioned, that a lot of it is because of the way they've done it that way always, and even when things are in the plans, they don't always make it onto the actual building.
Jim Motovalli is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. Dan Fetty is chairman of the Green Building Initiative of the Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas's association. We will take a quick break and return for your calls to 1-800-933-5372 and emails to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Informal Courses for Adults, offering a chance to explore the world from the SMU campus. You can learn more online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My name is Chris Boyd. We are talking this hour about trends in green building. My guests are Dan Fetty. He's chairman of the Green Building Initiative of the Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas. Also, Jim Motivalli's here. He is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Right before the break, Jim had brought up a retrofit suggestion that was turned down ultimately because it didn't sort of work for the existing owners. And I'm wondering about the trade-offs that Dan, you as a builder have to think about when you're either reconverting a house that already exists or deciding to put up a brand new house in terms of making it green and other accommodations that people want.
Well, it's kind of I guess you're weighing the costs versus the benefits in every consideration. You're aiming at resource efficiency. You're aiming at improving indoor air quality. You're aiming at keeping the initial cost as low as possible, so people can afford the house. And all of those together, several of them have impacts in all of those categories. As a matter of fact, green building is essentially a systems approach to building, where you're respectful of the fact that what happens in one part of the house affects what happens in another part of the house. I can give you a good example of that later. I'm not sure is that kind of the kind of thing you're getting at?
Yeah, trying to understand sort of where you have to draw the line. There might be times, I would imagine, when you say, yes, you could make this greener, but it's going to be too expensive or it'll be too hard. And then there might be other times when you say, it's probably going to be worth it to you, the home builder, the home buyer, rather.
You need to look at the task that way, the design, the configuration of the elements that comprise the finished product. And you also need to be respectful of how you put those pieces together. Let's say your aim is to make a house as energy efficient as possible. And so you orient the house with very little a possibility of solar heat gain from through windows. You make the house as airtight as possible. Run all of your ductwork for your air conditioning inside air-conditioned space. You don't put it in the hot attic. You create a space inside conditioned space. You do all of those things. You make put in really, really good insulation. If you do all of those things, then you need to do one more thing besides. You need to reduce the size of the air conditioner that would have gone into a typical house like that. If you don't, you've made the house so energy efficient that the air conditioner is going to hit its set point. It's going to, if you put in a big unit, it's going to hit its set point relatively quickly. A number of bad things happen when that occurs. Among them, you tend to have a humidity buildup in a house. If a air conditioner can run for a relatively long period of time, it's very effective at reducing humidity levels in the house. So you don't want high humidity because high humidity is a place for mold and mildew to grow. Your body actually feels more comfortable at a somewhat higher temperature and a lower relative humidity than it does at a colder temperature and a higher relative humidity. Say 80 degrees, your body is going to feel more comfortable at 80 degrees with relative humidity in the house at, say, 50% than it will at a temperature setting or a temperature of 75 degrees with 75% relative humidity. So it's back to what I was saying a minute ago. All of this is part of a system, and as you put the house together, it all has to be respectful of how all of those systems interplay.
Jim, are there common mistakes that you hear about people making? They think that they've made this great improvement when, in fact, it's going to have an unintended consequence on some other system in the house.
Yes, actually, following up on what Dan said. I think homeowners probably tend to get mesmerized by the latest technology, and they want this, 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 and this, when in actual fact, some of those things may not work all that well together. I think what you really need to do is, you know, I think people like it, for instance, if you're looking at a story about a greenhouse and it lists, it has this feature, and that feature. But what you really want to do is think about what actually will work in your space, what you, how big your space should be, whether you can take advantage of all kinds of natural daylight and things like that. You need to think a lot about it before you start ordering gadgets. That's one way I would look at it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to join the conversation, or you can email think@kera.org. Let's talk to Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, I'd like to help with that because I think there's a good argument for a house that breathes. And that's what they did before they had AC. There's a reason. As far as like these water catchment systems, I'm a landscaper. In the heavy clay soils of Dallas, you'd be better off creating a pond in your house that doesn't overflow. That may have problems with your foundation. Our water percolates at 1/1700th of an inch per hour. In Irving, where it's sandy, that wouldn't make a difference. But there, these things are very specific to the sites and the lots, and better placement of windows rather than fancy windows could do a lot to save heat. With parking lots, we do these things to preserve trees, but we doom the trees. So we have these laws and policies which don't really help what we think we're doing. And a lot of this comes down to, again, the individual thoughtfulness, not selling systems, but thinking things through and looking at what you have there and making it work for you. Thanks.
Scott, thanks for your call. And Dan, I know that this is certainly part of your association's plan, is making sure that the landscaping, for example, is appropriate to the climate in the region. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the provisions in the program is in the category of landscape that either all of the all of the landscaping plants in the yard have to be drought tolerant varieties, or 50% of the irrigation water necessary to serve the landscape of that house comes about through a rainwater catchment. So
it's all got a set of standards to go. And is there a website where people can also go and find more about the program?
Yes. The website for the HBA is www.dallasbuilders.com.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Teresa in Dallas. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'm actually a poor starving artist who lives in a mobile home, but I have done what I can to make my mobile home green by installing things like a tankless water heater, orienting the house where the full sun never hits the windows and where I can use wind through the house to cool it or warm it, putting the ductwork underneath the house in a protected space where it's warm and all, and increasing all the insulation. But that only goes so far. We've been looking at wind power, but we had a bad experience where a neighbor at one of the horse farms I train at put in a wind turbine for electricity, and the thing was so loud that it always sounded like there was a tornado coming, and it spooked the horses, got me thrown in a lot, and has kind of scared us off wind power, even though we have a great wind resource. Do you have any suggestions?
Jim, you want to take that one?
Well, I think you're talking about a fairly large wind turbine that's going to make noise. The ones I've encountered, I found even if you're standing at the base of them, you were not much bothered by noise. I think this is a case of needing to shop around and pay particular attention to that feature. I don't think that's an inherent problem with wind turbines because, as I say, I've encountered many of them that are virtually silent. Of course, it depends on where you are, too. And if you're in a sensitive area where there's a lot of horses that are easily spooked, I can see where that might be an issue. But and I think the size of the turbine, if you're looking at one for just a home use, I don't think you're looking at a very large turbine. And I think problem shouldn't be that big. I did want to commend you for using a tankless water heater, and that's something that I think a lot of people aren't aware of yet, but you save a lot of energy by going to that kind of design that basically just heats water on demand rather than keeping a large supply of water hot at all times, which is a very wasteful situation. And I certainly am looking to go to that type of heater. And I think you've done just about everything you could do. You didn't mention compact fluorescent bulbs, but I'm sure you do that too.
The quickest and easiest way to green up your house.
That's
a little
right.
Bit. Let's go next to Coy in Dallas with more on tankless water heaters. Hi, Coy.
Hi there. I was hoping that either or both of you could offer your opinions on tankless heaters, and I appreciate what you've said so far. Dan, do you have anything to add to that, or could you speak a little bit about geothermal heating and cooling?
Okay. Regarding the first question, I'll just give you a little bit different opinion on tankless water heaters from Jim's. One could design in place a heating system that uses hot water to provide for heating a house. That, in fact, is what we did on the project up in Denton, the Nevada Court project. This is a it's a heating piece of equipment that's manufactured here locally. It's actually manufactured in Irving, called Aquatherm. It uses hot water to heat a coil through which air passes and enters your ductwork and heats your house by. Well, in order for that thing to work efficiently, it really needs a tank water heater. So what we've got on those houses is one gas-burning appliance. It's the water heater. It sits out in the garage about 10 feet away from the indoor air handler. And in that assembly, a tank water heater is a very good idea, a very energy-efficient idea.
And the geothermal question?
Geothermal is a great way to heat and cool a house. It uses the relatively constant temperature of the earth down several feet below the surface to provide basically a heat sink and a heat source. Somewhat expensive. New technologies are in the offing that would increase the efficiency of systems like that and presumably reduce the cost. Still, right now is a little expensive.
Jim, you spoke earlier about people sometimes wanting the bells and whistles and not considering what's already available and out there. Are there technologies that you and your colleagues at the magazine have been following that haven't yet come as far as you would have expected them to by now?
Well, I mentioned earlier the use of fuel cells in homes, and General Electric, which is based up here in Connecticut, actually had a plan in place to start marketing home fuel cells. And this would be taking the natural gas line that comes into your house and extracting hydrogen from that, and then in the fuel cell creating electricity, which would take you off the grid. The problem is the fuel cell for that application is still producing electricity that costs more than the grid, which makes it not particularly efficient. You would end up spending a whole lot more money. So GE withdrew that product. But it is still something that would work if you were in a place where the grid does not go, if you're in a remote area. And fuel cells are being used very effectively as backup power in hospitals. There's probably one or two of them used in the Dallas area for backup power. Geothermal is another one that I thought was going to take off a little bit faster. But geothermal is an example of, again, geographic features come into play. I was just in Iceland, and you never see a more effective and cost-effective geothermal system than is what's in place for the 300,000 people of Iceland, because almost everybody has very cheap hot water. For instance, the hot water is directly out of the earth. If you turn on your tap, you're getting water that was heated in the core of the earth. But it just happens to be very close to the surface and very available in Iceland, which isn't always true. So a lot of the initial cost is drilling down and reaching that strata where you will find that level of heating. So some of these technologies have not moved as fast. Solar is another example of something that has always been an also-ran. If you go back to the Carter administration, President Carter put solar panels on the White House and wore a sweater in this famous speech and said that the great era of energy conservation was upon us. And indeed, that was true because the nation was still reeling from the Arab oil embargo. But as soon as fuel prices went down, Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the White House, and people stopped installing solar for the most part. It became dormant for about 20 years. Now it's starting to be seen again, and it's starting to be cost-effective. Not only is it becoming cost-effective, but there are more and more subsidies available for it. I would say electric cars is a little bit off the green building subject, but any battery application has been hampered by the fact that we don't have really great batteries. But with new lithium-ion and nickel metal hydride batteries, many different types of battery applications are becoming viable again. So these are all things that have been around for a long time. If you go back to 1910, there were more electric cars on the road than there were gas cars. And so it's not a new technology, but batteries are coming back, solar panels are coming back, fuel cells are starting to emerge. I think what we need, if we're looking at freeing the country from oil and fossil fuel dependence, it's not going to be any one thing. I don't think there's any magic bullets. It's a combination of all these things put together that is going to finally revolutionize our grid.
We have a very quick question before the break from Clay. Maybe you can take this one, Dan. How do residents with rainwater runoff tanks keep the water from getting stagnant?
The tanks that we're using are closed on the top. There's one entry to it. It's the intake. One exit. Actually, there's an overflow, but there's one exit. The water is used pretty quickly, so it really doesn't have that much opportunity to get stagnant. If you're going to use it for irrigation, then there's occasion to do that through the year.
Good to know. We will take a quick break and return with more of your calls and your emails. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. We're talking about trends in green building.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Informal Courses for Adults, offering a chance to explore the world from the SMU campus. You can learn more online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My name is Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, Jim Motivalli, and Dan Fetty. He is chairman of the Green Building Initiative of the Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Dan, I have to imagine this is a growth industry. How much change have you seen in the number of builders, even in this area, who are interested in providing homes with these qualifications?
Well, right now we have 52 builders signed up as participants in our Green Building Initiative. The program originated, beginning in about 2 years ago, actually. In October of 2005, we began the process of putting this program together. Our intent was to create sort of an organized protocol to help builder members respond to increasing market demand for green features in new homes. We had our program up and running by March of 2006. We officially launched the program publicly in August of 2006 with a grand opening of the Nevada Court subdivision. Had about 800 people show up to that grand opening. Very gradually, starting from, you know, no participants back in March when we launched the program to right now 52 builders participating in the program.
Could I just interject something here?
Sure.
I think it's a very interesting point. Really what we need is green building to reach a critical mass where it's like the norm.
So we stop calling it green building and it's just building.
Right, it's just building. But if you look at the picture nationally, it's a little hard to get it into focus. It's like asking how many vegetarians there are. For instance, if you look at what percentage of buildings are built according to the U.S. Green Building Council LEED standards, that's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, it's like 5% of new commercial construction. Doesn't really address home building. 10% of new homes, though, satisfy the federal government's Energy Star guidelines, so they're definitely better. That's like a third more energy efficient. Another statistic I've seen is that the National Association of Home Builders says that 50% of American home builders will participate in green building, but that's not the same thing as saying that 50% of new homes are green buildings. It's not. It's in fact, in 2005, only. And this is according to another statistic, which counters the other one I had, 2% of homes were built green. So it's a little unclear how much of this is really catching on and is having an impact. I think the number of homes that have some kind of green building aspects is really growing a lot. But this is not the norm. We can't just call it building because it's still a rarefied subcategory, unfortunately.
This is a little bit outside what we're talking about with building, but Mike in Saxe writes, we've done a lot around our home to save energy, compact fluorescents, new AC, more insulation. But he says, when I went to calculate how much power our Christmas lights were using, it was 2,700 watts, three times what our inside lights use at any time. Much development, do either of you know, in LED Christmas lights that would use
less
power?
Yeah, that's a very good point he's making. And I have this party every day on New Year's Day. And when I have the Christmas tree on and I plug in this big industrial coffee maker, it trips the circuit breaker every time. And that's because I have, probably for nostalgia reasons, I have the old shiny bright or whatever they're called, lights that use like 5 watts each.
Oh, the big fist size. Yeah.
But the LED lights are incredibly more energy efficient. If you switch to those, you will stop having these 2,700-watt demands and that kind of thing. It's simply old technology that we're still using.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk to Frank in Carrollton. Hi, Frank.
Hi, this is Frank. I've got two questions for you. By the way, I enjoy your show greatly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here we go. Where in Denton is this Nevada court located? I'm curious to see the models. And question number two is, photovoltaic cells for the roof. Can you give me a rough idea how much they cost? And I'm going to hang up.
Thanks.
The project, the Nevada Court project in Denton, is on Paisley Street. If you're at the corner of Loop 288 and McKinney, it is about a half a mile directly northwest. And regarding photovoltaics, photovoltaics are still pretty pricey. An 8-kilowatt array is probably going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $80,000. It's a very expensive proposition.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk next to Sarheen in Frisco. Hi, Sarheen.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, what are some programs for green building in Dallas? And the other one is kind of a comment/question. Green building should include healthy building, healthy home building, because green without healthy health considerations might lower energy costs and raise your health costs. And the thing I'm talking about is that, you know, it's well known that Texas is number one in mercury emissions from coal plants. And if we're insulating our houses better with forced AC, aren't we just taking the outdoor pollution and just concentrating it into our houses, you know, putting our kids at more risk for autism and ADD? Because a lot of autism groups, you know, point to mercury and vaccines. But in Texas, we have mercury in our air and we're concentrating it in our houses. So That's a huge consideration for me because right now I'm just really concerned about the air quality in our house. We moved from Ohio, and once we got here, we started having all kinds of ADD kind of issues, and I've never seen so many kids in school with ADD and autism. One out of three kids have autism or ADD.
Sorry, and thank you very much. I think we've got your question. Let's get an answer about what can be done to improve indoor air quality while making a house energy efficient.
I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I absolutely agree with you that that indoor air quality is a critical component of all of this. As a matter of fact, it has to be. If you're making a house more airtight, then you have to be more concerned than you might otherwise have been about pollutants inside the homes, like volatile organic compounds that accompany the finishes, the paint and the varnish and such on things in the house, about carbon monoxide buildup from combustion gases, formaldehyde off-gassing from carpet and furniture and such things as that. All of those are, in fact, addressed in the green building program that we put together at the HBA. Your comment about outdoor pollutants affecting indoor air quality. Well, while that might be true in some parts of the state, and I don't know, it might even be true here. The statistics that I'm familiar with are that typically air inside a building is more polluted than the air outside. So there would be a necessity for, one way or the other, incorporating fresh air sufficient to meet occupants' needs in a house.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk next to Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thank you for having this show.
Sure.
The question that I had was, I'm a potential first-time home buyer. And, I've been looking around, and I prefer to buy, I'm very environmentally sensitive. I prefer to buy an existing home rather than build a new home on virgin land that, could stay green space for a little bit longer. So what are the options that people in the Metroplex have? Is there a place that somebody who has a remodeling project or even a building project can go to get information on who, from an architect, from builders, from designers, who can we go to? Where can we find people that buy into green building today?
There are a number of kind of clearinghouses. There's no central clearinghouse. There are a number of sources of information. There are a couple of architecture firms in town. GGO Architects is really good with green building. Gary Ulp has been kind of championing this cause for a long time. The HBA of Greater Dallas, Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas, is a source of information for you. Regarding remodeling, we intend for our green building program at the HBA to address remodeling issues in the future. We currently do not have a protocol for that.
Jim, you had a fact in the magazine this month about the impact of not remodeling, but tearing down a house and what that means in terms of the environment if it's not carefully done. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, this is a growing movement to dismantle houses instead of just demolishing them, which does have a very big environmental impact because a huge amount of the material going into landfills is building waste. And it can actually be very cost-effective, even to the owner of the building, to have your house dismantled and the materials that are still, in some cases, irreplaceable, like beams made from virgin wood and that kind of thing, various maple wood sources that are really not obtainable or hard to find. A lot of these things are very valuable, and if it's dismantled and reused, you can actually save money. So there's a growing movement on that. Again, it's still very small, but it is showing itself to be very cost-effective.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk to Ken in Arlington. Hi, Ken.
Yes. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Thanks for putting this on.
Sure.
My question is, for a sunroom, what is the best glass to use? Obviously, in the winter on a sunny day, you need maximum heat absorption, but on a cloudy day, you want minimum heat loss. So what is the best glass to use?
I'll make a stab at it. I would recommend if the house or that sunroom is connected with the rest of the house, then you're going to be concerned about heat gain and heat loss. Low E windows, low emissivity windows would be an appropriate choice. And actually, down here in this locale, you're going to have a tough time finding windows that are not low E because code requires for all substantial remodeling projects, all new construction, for low E windows to be the windows of choice on construction projects.
And in addition to that, curtains, shutters, blinds, what's a good idea?
Well, in a sunroom, I don't know. You're trying to maximize the sunlight, so maybe mini blinds, maybe I don't know, maybe some kind of shading device strategically placed on the outside of the structure. So you're kind of tempering the time of day that or the time of year that you're getting direct sunlight into the room.
How much resale value is there for a house that's built green? Can an owner assume that they will get back the extra money that they spent on the house when they go to sell it, or are we not quite there yet?
Jim might answer this. I'm not familiar with national statistics that show that, or nor local ones. Jim, do you know?
I don't know of any actual statistics on that. One of the things that I've noticed is very true is if you personalize a house too much, that'll sometimes cause issues of saleability. In other words, people will want to personalize it to their own tastes. That may include green building in the sense that if you make the house too much along your own guidelines, you might have a little bit of trouble reselling it. I think if you do just some fairly basic things that everyone can relate to, I don't see where there's an issue. And I think in a lot of cases it would definitely add to the value if you can show potential buyers that they will be able to save a whole lot of money on energy bills and things like that. So I think it's a net positive. There might be some obstacles to it.
I can tell you that our goal with the HBA's program is to demonstrate just that there is definite value to the kinds of features that are being required as part of that program. For example, if you can save $100 a month on your utility bills, you live in a house for 30 years, $100 a month, that's over $36,000. So, a lot of money.
Dan Fetty is chairman of the Home Builders Association of Greater Dallas's Green Building Initiative. Jim Motovalli is editor of E, the environmental magazine. We have links to both of their websites on our website. Thank you so much for both of you for spending the hour with us.
Great to be on.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.